President Obama is holding a press conference about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and joining me now to discuss what the president said is Jonathan Capehart, Washington Post editorial writer and MSNBC contributor. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
I'm okay. Earlier today, it was announced that Elizabeth Birnbaum, the head of the U.S. Minerals Management Services, was leaving her post. Did she resign, or was she kind of pushed out?
Well, that was a question that came up just a moment ago, where the president said that he was informed that Ms. Birnbaum was leaving by, I believe he said, Secretary Ken Salazar of the Interior Department. The word leaked out hours before the president's press conference that she was going. And, you know, I think a lot of people wouldn't be blamed for not knowing who she is, because as the New York Times wisely and correctly pointed out yesterday, she has been, or had been, the invisible chief of the Minerals Management Service. This is the agency that's in charge of regulating companies like BP that drill offshore for oil.
Now, the White House has been criticized for being a little lackadaisical in its response to this crisis. Is it trying to appear more forceful in its response now, both politically and on the ground?
Yes, more so on the politically part, because as the president said and has been saying repeatedly through the press conference, he's now on a question about Afghanistan from Helen Thomas, but the key points the president was trying to make and trying to get across on all the discussions on the BP mess is that from the very beginning, his administration has been on top of this. The very first day, he had meetings with his senior staff in the Oval Office to get on top of things. And he also made the point and continues to make the point that there is nothing that BP is doing or can do without the input and approval of the federal government. So the notion that BP is out there by itself, you know, making decisions and doing things without input from the president or from the government is false.
Well, that despite the fact that there were complaints from the government that certain chemicals used to disperse the spill might be toxic and unwelcome?
Well, there's that. I mean, the president also acknowledged that even though they are they have all the authority they need to direct BP to do what they wanted to do, they also recognize that they have to exercise it effectively or efficiently, as he said, and that the disbursements piece of that, I think, is what comes under that, you know, exercising that authority efficiently and effectively.
Karl Rove called this President Obama's Katrina in today's Wall Street Journal. The president was asked about that. Are you surprised that he said that he'd leave it up to the press corps to determine whether it was his Katrina or not?
I was not surprised by that, because I think then he plays into the hands of his political enemies. The Katrina is such a, you know, one of those singer moments in this country's history that, you know, picked the scab of some of several wounds of the nation's consciousness. And I think the president doesn't want to get bogged down in that game. And if you were listening, you noticed he went right back to his message, which is where we have been on top of this from the beginning. We are on top of this still, and we are making sure that BP does everything that it can do and everything that we want it to do and pay for it.
And the president will be traveling to the Gulf oil spill tomorrow. Is this part of the White House's effort to minimize the political damage, do you think?
I think it's part of that effort, but it's also, I think, a recognition of the fact that the political game was getting away from them. We all know that the administration has been in the middle of all this from the beginning, but people were not seeing it. The American people were not seeing it. And I think people forget that, you know, when the president goes down tomorrow, this won't be his first time down there. This will be his second trip down there. He was there about a week after the initial explosion in Louisiana. And as we've seen over the last 24 hours or so, a series of more high-profile announcements and moves being made by the president and the administration to make sure people understand that the federal government might be slow in some areas in trying to respond to this situation, but it is not absent by any means to addressing these problems. One thing we all have to get a handle on is that this is a disaster and a rupture that's about a mile below the Gulf surface, in a region where no human can go, as the president said in his remarks. And so, you know, we're at the mercy of companies and experts who might not be within the federal government. But as he said, you know, the federal government has all the authority it needs to make sure that BP does what it needs to do to cap this. This has been a slow-rolling disaster. It's taken a while for the frustration and exasperation to hit this fever pitch. But as that oil washes up on the coastline of Louisiana and perhaps even Mississippi and Alabama in the days and weeks ahead, I think it's going to hit home to a lot of people that you know, there are things that happen to, you know, satisfy the nation's thirst for oil that, you know, end up coming back to bite us. And in a disaster like this, we're discovering that there are limits to how fast humans can be at capping something or repairing something this catastrophic.
Well, just a month or so ago, he was promoting increased offshore drilling. So is this a complete about face? Was he responding to political pressure then? Now has that eased a bit?
Yes. Well, back then when he announced his offshore drilling plan, it was part of a bigger, comprehensive energy plan with the recognition that until the states can ramp up to scale, you know, all of these green energy sources, wind, solar, and other energy sources, we are going to have to still rely on coal and oil, and we have to push into nuclear. And so, you know, being pragmatic and realistic about it, he pushed forward with a drive to conduct more offshore drilling off the coast, the East Coast and the Gulf of Mexico and up and around Alaska. But, you know, plans change when disaster strikes, and this is more than a disaster. This is a catastrophe, and I think the president and the administration would have been dumb and politically deaf, to say the least, if it did not move quickly to change its plans in this regard. If this disaster can happen, and it's going on now for a month, and will probably go on for a lot longer, and you have a minerals management service that is rife with corruption and now leaderless, and you have certain regulations that are in place that make it impossible for MMS to effectively regulate the oil industry, then you can't move forward with the plan as he announced it more than a month ago.
Well, he's being criticized by Republicans in different ways. Rand Paul is saying one thing, Bobby Jindal is saying something else. But can we expect Republicans to use this as an issue against the president and the Democrats in the fall's midterm elections?
Well, we're seeing it already. I mean, Karl Rove's op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal today about this being the president's Katrina. This morning on Morning Joe, Congressman Mike Pence was slamming the president, saying, you know, he needs to lead, without actually saying what that means. The Republican Party is trying to use this in as many ways as possible to embarrass the president, but that doesn't mean that there aren't some issues there that the administration and this president have to deal with, because this is a disaster on his watch, and he's going to have to solve it.
I've been talking with Jonathan Capehart, Washington Post editorial writer and MSNBC contributor, in response to the president's press conference that we've been streaming on WNYC.org. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thanks a lot, Leonard.
Last week, the Jamaican government declared a state of emergency after fighting broke out in the streets of the capital city of Kingston. But the violence actually has its roots in a court case that was brought in a federal court in New York. Joining me now to explain how attempts to extradite gang leader Christopher Dudas Koch have sparked violence are Mark Lacey, Mexico City Bureau Chief of the New York Times, covers Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean for the paper, and Larry Burns, Director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to today's second underreported segment. Who is Chris? Go ahead.
Hello to you.
Hi. Who is Christopher Dudas Koch, and is he appropriately named? Isn't he a drug dealer?
Well, he certainly is a drug dealer. And he is the local don of not only drug trafficking in Jamaica, but the route coming up from the northern tip of South America through the Caribbean via Trinidad and Tobago, which is a kind of alternate drug trafficking route to the Mexican route. And so one notices whenever there's pressure on what's happening in Mexico, a dispute over the use of the military to abate drug trafficking, you have a corresponding increase in activity along the Caribbean route. And the administration has long been aware of this. I guess it chose to apply pressure now for some kind of murky reason. I haven't quite understood why.
Well, it's partly because of a court case that's taking place in New York.
But it's not just the court case. It's also the question of why relent on the pressure being applied to President Uribe of Colombia, who simply came up with a scheme to end the extradition to the United States while you're applying pressure on the Jamaicans. The policy lacks consistency.
Mark, aren't there connections between Christopher Koch and the Prime Minister of Jamaica, the head of the Jamaica ruling Labor Party, Bruce Golding?
Absolutely. Christopher Koch is the don of a neighborhood called Trivoli Gardens in West Kingston. It's the same area that Bruce Golding represents in Parliament. This is an area that always votes for the Jamaica Labor Party. And one of the reasons why this area always votes for the Jamaica Labor Party is because the gunmen in this area make sure that voters support one party. This is a part of Jamaica's history that neighborhoods and gunmen and dons determine political leanings of neighborhoods. And so there are definite links between this man and the governing party in Jamaica, and that's what's made this so murky, this court case in New York so murky and so controversial in Jamaica.
Well, Koch has got, his consulting company has got a number of government contracts. I guess that's a show of gratitude by the JLP. But the
Leonard, just let me interject and say that the saintly Mark could have made the same statement about the opposition political party, the PNP, which also has a neighborhood which with its gunmen. And this situation has existed for decades. That is, when I was in Jamaica in 1970, in the 70s, the political gangs control these communities. I mean, Edward Siaga, in fact, took me for a walk into Covenant Gardens. And this is a situation that is peculiar to Jamaica. But the kind
well, it sounds of like war. It sounds like warlords who then support one government or another.
Well, they were Teflon Dons, is what they are.
Now, the original extradition request was made by the United States 9 months ago, and the Jamaican government is suddenly trying to comply with it. Do we know why now?
Yeah, well, actually, the prime minister initially hesitated to send Koch to the United States, and it took many months of controversy in Jamaica, a lot of pushing from the opposition party, and you're absolutely right that both parties in Jamaica have connections to criminal elements. This is a part of Jamaica's history. The ruling party, however, resisted sending Koch. It turned into a big controversy, and eventually the prime minister, whose government was wobbling, who was on the verge of resigning the prime ministership, he was losing support, he eventually agreed that the extradition should go forward. However, getting Mr. Koch and actually sending him to the United States is easier said than done, and the search for him continues. There's talk that he could be in some other part of Jamaica. He could be outside the country. Nobody knows where this guy is right now.
It's kind of ironic, isn't it, that we're trying to get him because we deported him. The United States deported him from North Carolina some years back. He had lived here in New York City in the Bronx and then was deported from North Carolina. Now people are trying to find him in Jamaica. But there's fighting going on. Is the fighting confined to one part of Kingston?
Well, I, by chance, was I do a Jamaican program, an average of once a week or so. I'm on a panel with some other non-pundits, and we chat away. And today was the day, and 7:30 in the morning, I asked about the conditions there, and they said that it's almost when you're in the Pegasus Hotel in downtown Kingston, you don't realize anything as much is going on. And that they emphasize that this is a kind of local thing. It's in that neighborhood where Koch rules supreme.
But 44 people have died so far in the fighting. That's a lot of people. And the government declared a state of emergency.
Population of what, 3 million? That's it's maybe kind of not a lot of people. And when you think of similar types of instances, like there was a confrontation in Bolivia a number of months ago in which over 100 people were killed.
So why is the government declared a state of emergency if so little of the country is affected?
Well,
the state of emergency actually applies to these neighborhoods where mm-hmm. where the fighting's taking place. The fighting has extended outside of Tivoli Gardens, where I've been in the past, and it's in neighboring communities as well. But it is not up in the hills where the business hotels are, where the wealthy people of Kingston live. This is a battle in the slums, in some of the poorest parts of Kingston. And in those communities, though, this is a real crisis, and people are huddled in their homes. I've been on the phone to people who are in these neighborhoods, and there are police and soldiers that are continuing to exchange gunfire with people in the community. So it's ongoing, and it is a real battle in these neighborhoods.
Well, we've been talking about drugs as an economic activity. The legitimate Jamaican economy relies mostly on tourism and on remittances. I would assume that the fighting is going to hurt the tourist industry.
Yeah, 20% of the income comes from tourism. Tourists don't particularly like to see AK-47s around, and this is going to have a very negative effect upon an already fragile economy. The mystery has always been, to my light, has been what is the economy of this region? What do they do? What do they produce? And if you go over it island by island, you discover that in many respects, none of these places, or only one or two, have viable economies. And clearly, the Obama administration is not prepared to take on a big-ticket item of attempting to bring economic resources to Jamaica. In fact, in the early 80s, under President Reagan, you had the advent of the Caribbean Basin Initiative, the CBI, which very specifically was meant to be a trade, not aid, formula. Of course, it didn't get much trade going, and the economy really hasn't improved since then. And it's something to really worry about, but this administration, like its predecessor, haven't done much worrying in this area.
Well, we don't have much time, but Mark, just one more question.
If I can just jump in, very few tourists go to Kingston. Tourists go to other airports hours away from Kingston. The beaches of Jamaica are still functioning, and certainly some tourists will be scared off by the news reports, but tourists visiting Jamaica go nowhere near Kingston on their Caribbean vacation.
Well, Mark, we're talking to you from Mexico City. We hear a lot about Mexicans' problems with drugs. Has Jamaica's drug trafficking been overlooked by the press generally in the United States?
No, Jamaica's drug trafficking is nothing new. It's been going on for decades, and there's been a consistent route of cocaine and marijuana through Jamaica to South Florida, to New York, through other parts of the United States. So that continues. As Mexico cracks down more, it is true that the traffickers are looking elsewhere, and some islands of the Caribbean are reporting increased seizures and more trafficking in their areas, and they attribute it to the aggressive crackdown in Mexico. But Jamaica has had a long-standing problem with drugs.
Well, thank you both so much for talking with us. Mark Lacy is Mexico City Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Larry Burns is Director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. We've been talking about Jamaica's state of emergency in our second underreported segment today.